Okay, we're just coming up on just almost 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and mute all. As usual, you will have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so if you have a comment or question. Remute yourself afterwards. Keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, contents of the deck in a PDF format, as well as the contents of the chat and the audio track will be available on our website. And with that, I will throw it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Okay, so tonight we have a few different items, but I think we'll have time for questions at the end. So if you have things that you want to know about, keep your questions until we get to the last 10 minutes. Okay, starting off, I've got a share here on a program that creates multi-boot USBs. So this thing, it's called Ventoy, and you can basically use things like ISO files or image file, disk image files, that WIM is Windows Imaging Format, and VHD, of course, is virtual hard drive from things like virtual machine managers. So you copy some of these things onto the bootable drive, and then you get a menu selection, and you can choose which one you want to run. And Ventoy supports Windows and Linux, and also Chrome, Chrome OS. And as you see, it deals with VHDs from VMware and so forth. One of the nice things is it's open source, so that means it's also free to try, and you don't have to buy. However, it has an interesting little wrinkle which caught me by surprise the first time. So you basically go onto the site and go to the downloads area, and you will find a bunch of different options. And I chose the zip file. So the basically it's an install. You unpack the zip file, and you will get the installer files. So when you unpack the zip file, you end up with a bunch of files and a bunch of folders, and you run this Ventoy to disk.exe file, and that brings up the install window. So it tells you what you basically select where you want to create this bootable USB. So I've chosen this 8 GB flash drive, and then typically you just hit install. And interestingly, it asks you, it warns you that when you install Ventoy on this flash drive, it will delete anything on the drive. So you have to say yes, you agree to that, you understand that's what's going to happen. And interestingly, it then asks you exactly the same question again as a double check. So they're really careful about not blowing away important information on flash drives. So you have to work at it to actually install the programming and get rid of anything that was existing on that drive. But once you've jumped through those hoops, it installs fairly quickly, and it says, congratulations, Ventoy has been installed, and you open the drive in Windows File Explorer, and it says that the folder is empty, I thought that was a little odd. I was expecting to see something on that drive. However, going to the source of our knowledge, back to the website, and look at the documentation, and it basically says that, as you can read here, once you install the program, the USB drive actually has two partitions. However, one partition isn't visible in File Explorer. But that's actually got the bootable part. It's formatted with XBAT. And it has the bootable files on there. And what you need to do is copy files to that partition. Sorry, the first partition, it's the other partition that has the bootable files. It isn't visible. The visible one, you copy the files that you want to run onto that partition. And you can put any of these kind of files, just drag and drop them into that partition, and Ventoy will sort everything out. So essentially that's what I did. I opened the second File Explorer window, pointed it at another drive that has a whole bunch of different different programs on it. So I've chosen gparted, which is the GNU partition editor, which I use quite often. That's a bootable utility program. I also copied over a program called Redo Rescue, which is similar to RescueZilla. In fact, RescueZilla is actually a fork of Redo Yet Rescue, because Redo Rescue wasn't being supported, but apparently now somebody's picked it up again. It's open source again. Somebody's picked up Redo Rescue, and so I wanted to have a look at that, see how it worked. So I basically selected both of these files, the check marks here, and then left click and drag and drop them into this Ventoy folder, which was empty. And the result, of course, is that now I've got my two ISO files on the Ventoy flash drive. And you recall that this flash drive is bootable. So now I get out of Windows and I reboot the computer and I tell it to boot from my flash drive. And when I do that, then sure enough, I get the Ventoy boot menu. And you can see in this menu, I can choose, by default, it takes the first one, but I could scroll down and run Redo Rescue if I wanted to do that instead. And the reason that's working as stated is if you look at this disk under disk management, you will see that indeed there is a partition here. And there are two partitions. There's a small partition here. Sorry, there's a small partition over here, which is the bootable program. And this partition is the larger partition, which contains these various ISO files. And clearly, you can put as many ISO files into that partition as will fit in this case, in an 8 GB flash drive. So as advertised, Ventoy does create two different partitions. One's the working partition, if you like. The other one is the data partition. And you're not limited to Linux distros. Here's an example from their website where they've got a bunch of different kind of things. There's a version of Windows 7, for example. Here's a version of Windows 10. And CentOS is one of the Linux distros. FreeBSD is a Linux-like, Unix-like program. Ubuntu Linux is well known. And here's a VMware type program. And so anything that you want to run, which you can obtain in the form of an ISO file and some kind of disk image file, you can actually run from this bootable drive. And you actually don't have to install the ISOs. It's all done by magic in the background. So it's a really handy way for running multiple applications that require a flash drive and be able to store a lot of these different applications on a single high capacity flash drive. So it's a very useful little program. Okay.
Alan, before you move on, because those are ISO files, they obviously have to be unpacked to actually run. Do you actually need spare space? Like if you were to choose, for example, Windows 10, do you need spare scratch space somewhere where it's going to unpack all of the files in that ISO and then run them? Or how does it work? Do you know?
That's a good question. I actually don't know. Okay. I've only tried it with these Linux distros, and they're fairly small. I mean, gparted is only a few hundred meg, and a typical distro is you know, 700 meg or like 1.2 gig or something.
It's not like a zip
Windows,
file.
Which was that 5 or 6 gig?
It's not like a zip file. You
so
don't have to unpack it. You don't have to unpack it. It can run directly from the disk, just like a, for example, a bootable Unix distro runs right from the disk. You run the ISOs and so on right from the disk. There's also an alternative called Yummy, which does the same thing, except that it gives you better support. It actually points you to where all the ISOs are and so on for a whole bunch of bootable disks.
But an ISO file, I didn't think that they were writable. And, of course, Windows 10 requires a writable media to actually operate. So does it actually write the changed files into the ISO?
Well, you can put an ISO on a CD, and that CD is not very writable afterwards. You don't need a writable install media.
Well, Windows 10 requires a writable somewhere to write to. You can't run Windows from a read-only media.
But you can install it from read-only media. The other things you can, I don't know about if they do need any local storage, but you can't run, I don't think, you can't run Windows from a USB.
Okay, so this would just be to install it from that. Okay, gotcha.
Well, you can actually, I mean, you can run it so long as you don't need to write to it, because I don't think it would support writing to inside of an ISO that's on a on a USB.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So I think that in the case of Windows, this would just be an install point as opposed to being able to do a live running of it like you can do with Linux distros where you can actually run it from a flash drive. But even that, I guess, you'd still have to be doing... I don't know. I'm confused.
The Linux distros use memory, but they don't write anything back to the flash drive.
Okay.
So things like Yumi or maybe Rufus, you can actually set aside space on the flash drive to use for write space.
Okay.
I don't know whether Ventoy does that. I actually use Yumi. I like Yumi. It's a nice little program too. But typically, I just use them to run things. I don't try and save stuff back to the drive.
Okay, I'm a little less confused. That's good.
Yeah, you can run Windows from the flash drive or from a CD, but the actual reading and writing it has to do while operating, and be on the computer that you're running it on. Any swap files or whatever.
So Bob is asking if Ventoy is bootable. Yes, it is. Could it be used if Windows ever fails to start up? Yes, because it as Tom said, it runs and it becomes, it's like the installer. So it gives you the option to repair Windows or to reinstall Windows, refresh Windows. So if your Windows died, you could actually use this to make it well again or reinstall it completely, for example.
That's true. You could put a Windows ISO on there for installing or repairing, but you're probably better off to use your own computer's software to create a restore or a rebuild disk, because that will contain all the proper drivers and so on that will actually make your computer run properly.
Yeah, that works fine for people who think ahead, I guess, Tom.
Some people are paranoid.
Corinne is asking, how do you know that these files are virus-free? I assume she's thinking of the ISO files. If so, you are downloading those, so they run through your virus checker as you download them. And if you're really concerned, you can send them to virustotal.com and kind of do a double check. And usually, Linux distros, for example, you can also download a hash code and check that the hash code is correct. So there are all kinds of different ways you can check that the system is reasonable.
One thing I recently discovered is that the program glass wire, which some people use. There's a free version that kind of gives you a look at what your network activity is. But one of the things it does is it will check the with VirusTotal any new programs that start accessing the internet. So I just, but you do need an API key from VirusTotal to put into GlassWire.
Yeah, it's free. It's not too hard to set up. But yeah, one problem you could run into for sure was using Ventoy, because the ISOs may be quite large, certainly in the case of Windows. VirusTotal has a maximum file size of 650 megabytes. So the ISOs are going to be well over that. So that would limit your ability to use VirusTotal to check the files. But I think by and large, when it comes down to it, when you download anything off of the internet, you have to decide, you know, are you getting it from a trustworthy source? And that is your first line of defense. Certainly, if the files can be checked with VirusTotal, I do it on a pretty religious basis on anything that I download program-wise, even if it's coming from a trusted source, because who knows if they got compromised. You know, my downloads are infected, so I will submit any program that I download to VirusTotal as long as it's under the size limit of 650 megabytes, which most programs are. So that's a consideration for sure.
Okay, so our next item is Bob Walker from Sunnybury at Shepherds. And Bob, I believe you're going to share your screen.
Yep, here we go. Okay. Okay. So what I'm going to start tonight is a little mini series that I call Windows 11 Quick Start Guide for Windows 11 Luddites. And Luddites are people that are opposed or resistant to new technologies or technological change. And this is a tongue-in-cheek guide for going to Windows 11 for those that aren't really keen on it. Windows 11 has had a somewhat mixed reception in the IT world. For every article, expert, pundit, etc., that advertises or that advises upgrading to Windows 11, there's at least one other one that advises sticking with Windows 10, at least for the time being, and maybe until Microsoft fixes some more of the issues with Windows 11, or until the upcoming release of Windows 12, which is expected sometime in 2024. Microsoft seems to be following its merry old tradition of disappointing us with every second release of Windows. Windows XP was pretty good. Windows Vista, not so much. Windows 7 was really good. Windows 8 was a bit of a disappointment, and it took 8.1 to get it halfway decent. Windows 10 was great. Windows 11 has had very mixed reviews, as I've mentioned, and who knows what's coming with Windows 12. The question of should I or shouldn't I upgrade, there's four articles here that give both sides of the story, and you can, if you download the deck, you can check out these articles. There's many more of the same ilk, and I believe Chris will be pasting these URLs into the chat sooner or later.
Yeah, they're there.
The biggest reason not to upgrade to Windows 11 is that your existing computer doesn't meet the technical specifications required, especially the requirement for the Trusted Platform Module, or TPM. The biggest reasons for the average user to upgrade to Windows 11 is that now you have a spanking new computer that came with Windows 11, and it just doesn't make sense to downgrade to your good old familiar Windows 10. That said, if you have a new computer but aren't exactly overflowing with enthusiasm for Windows 11, i.e., can I make it like Windows 10 until Windows 12 comes out? Then this little series is for you. Several experts have commented that many of the differences between Windows 10 and Windows 11 are not actually improvements, but were made just to be different so they could differentiate Windows 11 from Windows 10. And if a change isn't an improvement, is it actually a diminishment? That's a sort of a philosophical question there. And one of the biggest criticisms Microsoft has faced with the Windows 11 is that in the original release, they severely limited the freedom users had with Windows 10 to customize their user interface. Subsequent minor and major updates to Windows 11 have given some of that customizability back, but it's not yet possible to make Windows 11 exactly like Windows 10, at least not without using third-party apps. But let's see what's possible. Okay, here's a whole slide here full of ways to make Windows 11 look like Windows 10. Some of them are articles and some of them are YouTube videos. Oh, and here's another slide full. And again, these will all be pasted into the chat. You can see that there's no shortage of advice online for making Windows 11 as much like Windows 10 as possible. And the preceding list was just the tip of the iceberg. However, this is a continuously moving target as Microsoft keeps making minor and major adjustments to Windows 11. So some of the suggested tips in these articles and videos may no longer apply. This series will have some tips on setting up a computer that came with Windows 11. It won't be the actual step-by-step setup, because there's lots of information on that available. And indeed, if you have a computer that came with Windows 11, it'll step you through the setup. I'll give you a couple of gotchas you got to look out for, though. And some of you may have found solutions that I haven't found yet to some of the issues that I'm going to bring up. Okay, I'll be the first to admit I'm not a Windows 11 expert. Far from it. And that's why I decided to do this mini-series of presentations for those people that may be in the same boat as me to make their transition easier and so that they won't make some of the same mistakes I did. When I'm given this series, please feel free to chip in with your own solutions to any of the things I bring up because, after all, the OPCUG is all about users helping users. I've got to be a bit of a Luddite on Windows 11 because I've been through 50 years worth of operating systems from mainframes to mini computers to Apple Macintosh to various flavors of DOS and virtually every flavor of Windows since then. And I'm just sort of the glow I get, the challenge I get from trying a new operating system just isn't quite there anymore. So hopefully starting next week's Q&A, I'll have three or four episodes of what to do. And the first one will be the major gotchas of what not to do when you start up the computer and start the setup. And that's it for now.
One of the things I'll comment on right up front on this is that a reminder that we don't run a computer to run an operating system. We run a computer to run the programs that run under an operating system. And so I think keep that in mind, that really the facilities and capabilities that are built into the operating system really should be secondary to what you use your computer for, which is all the other programs. Now, there are bundled programs, and Microsoft is certainly putting some emphasis into the add-on programs that you get with Windows 11 and some features that they're not backporting to Windows 10, but they are backporting a bunch of stuff to Windows 10. And so if you're happy with Windows 10, you know, you may want to stick with it. But I look forward to your future presentations, Bob. Thanks.
Yeah, I've been in high tech and in the computer business for about 50 years or so now. And to me, the computer has always been a tool to get things done.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in computers to be interested in computers. I'm interested in computers for what they can do for me. Yeah. So
I think that's a very sane way of looking at it.
Okay, thanks very much, Bob. We look forward to future episodes. And in the meantime, we're going to go to Chris, who's got a share.
Yeah, so I read about this, that Microsoft had updated the Paint program in Windows 11 when it came to 23H2, which just came out this fall. The official release of it was October 31st. And if you haven't got it yet and you're really dying to get 23H2, maybe next month or next week I'll do a very quick share on some – actually, I guess it won't be next week. It'll be in 2 weeks on how you can force upgrading to 23H2 if you really want it. At any rate, there was an update to the Paint app that came out in 23H2, and the biggest difference in it is has new – remove background feature, which I thought, well, that might be kind of cool. I've used a number of programs that can do background removal from photos with varying degrees of success. And there are some online tools, and some of them do a very good job. Some of them have some limitations, like maximum output size of about 1,024 pixels by 800 pixels and things like that. So I decided, well, I'd take a look at this and see if it does anything terribly useful. Next. So it is very easy to use. So here we see this is in the new version of Paint, and I brought in an image of Bruce Schneier, who's a guru in security. And next. And you'll see on the toolbar, you have this new icon. If you hover your mouse over it, the tooltip says remove background. So you just click on that. Next. And sure enough, it removes the background. And so anything that it's removing will be shown as a checkerboard. And when you save that as a PNG file, those areas will be transparent. So don't save it as a JPEG, because JPEG doesn't support transparency. So you just end up with a white background. But if you save it as PNG, those areas that are showing up and checkerboard will be saved transparent. Next. So here's the original. So the question is, why would you want to do a background removal? And here's a really good example, I think, of a case where you would want to remove the background. So here's my original picture of Bruce Schneier. Next. And then if I did a mock-up of some kind of poster or something like that, it might look like this. Bruce Schneier, security guru, and a quote. And I stuck his picture there, and I made sure that the text was over top of the photo so that you could read it, so forth. So, it's doable. But next, doesn't this look a lot better? So basically it's the same idea, Bruce Schneier, security guru. I layered the photo on top of the text, and because it's got a transparent background, it's only showing the Bruce Schneier part of it. And then I can actually tuck the quote in there. The user is going to pick dancing pigs over security every time. I can actually tuck that in closer to him because I don't have to worry about it being under or over top of that gray part in the original image. So I think most people would agree that this is a use case where removing that background makes a much, much more attractive final product. Next. So it is a very blunt instrument. So you click the button and it does it. You can't refine what it considers to be the background. So you can't decide, this part here removed too much, I want to put that back, or I want to remove additional stuff and click on other things and have it remove additional material. It's just a one-click operation. It does what it does, and you can't modify it. Now, it does a very good job, like that example of Bruce Schneier, where there's a simple background. It does a really, really good job, but not so much with complex backgrounds. Next. So is there a better tool for doing background removal? And I think yes. PhotoScape X which has a free version, and that does include what they call a cutout feature, and it allows you to refine areas that you want removed or kept. And they have a magic eraser with tolerance control, and it basically looks for areas that are the same color or luminance values, and it will, whatever you click on, it will look for other areas around that are very similar. And again, you have that tolerance control, and it'll remove other stuff. And you can click on multiple areas to get additions or subtractions from that. It does have a brush as well, where you can brush in or out. And that's if things were not treated very well by the magic eraser, then you can actually go in and refine them by just clicking with a brush or dragging or painting with a brush to add in or take out additional areas. And you can control the shape and the size of the brush. Next. So here's a poster I found in a window of a shop downtown. I thought it was pretty funny, so I took a picture. And if you look at it, you know, what do you consider to be the background? Is it the black around the white page? Or is it everything that is around Christopher Walken? Depending on your use case, you may decide that something different is the background than the program would. Next. This is if Paint was using it with the background removal tool, and then I just exported it as a PNG, and I dropped it on top of a yellow background. And this is what it did. So it basically thought that everything outside of the white page was background, but it left in some semi-transparent stuff down along the bottom and across the top and things like that. So somewhat of a messy job. It wasn't really what I was after. Next. And here's how it turned out if I did use Photoscape X and I used their cutout feature. And I spent probably about 2 or 3 minutes refining it to say what I wanted added back in and removed and so forth. And in this case, I was able to get Christopher Walken's with the text underneath it and everything else removed quite cleanly, and a much better job, I thought, for the final results. Next. So if everybody wants a demo, our resident Photoscape X expert, Linda, who's on the call tonight, she's more than happy to come back in 2 weeks and actually demo doing background removal using Photoscape X to show that it can be pretty easy to do, and it can do a much more refined job than paint program will do. It's not a single click, but it can be pretty quick and easy to do it. And so let us know either in the chat or unmute yourself or something like that. And if there's sufficient interest, Linda's more than happy to do a demo in 2 weeks. That's all I have on that.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So I put a note in the chat asking who wants a demo, and I've got one taker so far. So keep them coming. Okay, in the meantime, we have this series that we call Loony Bits, which actually Stu started off, which is looking for Canadian websites that have information that's interesting, but with a Canadian flavor. And we ask, can you send us things that you find interesting? And Tom, a few weeks back, suggested a number of what he called Loony Links, and he's back tonight, and he's got one, which is called Dotto Tech.
Yes, I prefer Loony Links because it's way more alliterative than Loony Bits. So my Loony Link is Dotto Tech. He has a big YouTube channel with more than 1,000 videos up so far. He also has a website and stuff, and he gives a regular Wednesday webinar every Wednesday afternoon that's available for 1 week afterwards. I find that he concentrates on common programs like Google or Apple Notes and other things that are used by a large number of people. He brings forward the new stuff that is coming up in Google Maps or Google Contacts or whatever thing he's looking at. So I would, he's really good to look at it. Can I go to the next one? So here's a start, for example. Camtasia is a basically a web. It's a way of capturing your screen. It's been around for ages and ages. Although it's 2022 here, I'm sure Camtasia has been around for 20 years. Apple Notes, multi-stop route planning, and Google Maps. This is an example of things that he does, content creation and productivity tutorials. But he has a whole bunch of other things that he looks at. And there's 1,000 videos that you can search for on YouTube to actually explain things that you'd like to know more about. Next. So there's a free webinar every Wednesday. I think it's, I forget the time. I think it's something like 1 p.m. Eastern. I forget. You'd have to go to his website to check. I haven't looked at any of his webinars, but he is very clear and simple in his talking. And it's, I find he's, for the things that I looked at him for, he's very clear and simple. And so I recommend him. I think there's another slide, isn't there?
No, there isn't. That was it.
Okay. So you can see this is his website. I think it's dottotech.com. So he's been around a while. And as you said on the first slide, he was doing things before YouTube to make tech easier. So I enjoy him and I recommend him.
Yeah, he used to have a television program, which I think was called Dotto Tech. And back in the day, it was quite a while ago since I've seen that thing.
Well, you know, Twit TV, the guy there, Leo, who just turned 67, young guy, you know, he used to run a community community TV program on tech in Toronto on Rogers, I believe. So a lot of people started off in TV, and this is the newest TV.
Yeah, very good. Thanks very much, Tom. Okay, well, as well as Loony Bits, or I like Loony Links, I must say. We also have this thing on smart apps, which are applications, programs, utilities that people find useful for Android devices. And we're asking what are your favorites, but I always put this note in saying it can also be your favorite program that you run on your PC, on the, i.e. under Windows or Linux or whatever. And if you recall, a couple of weeks ago, I was talking about micro USB drives, thumb drives, and my application for that was to stick one in the car with a bunch of music on it. So what I needed to do was basically rip some CDs and convert the tracks on the CDs to MP3 files and then store those MP3 files on this micro USB device that would then plug into a USB port on the car. And the first thing that comes to mind is it actually legal to do that? Or is it illegal to do that, I guess? And we have an Act of Parliament called the Copyright Act of Canada, and it basically says that it's not infringing on copyright to reproduce something if, and then there's a bunch of caveats. You can copy stuff as long as the original is owned by you and was obtained, basically it was purchased. You're not allowed to copy stuff that you borrowed from the library or rented from somewhere. But if you purchase the original work, then you're allowed to copyright it, as long as you don't break copyright protection on the device in some way. A lot of systems, music especially, CDs, they don't have copyright protection, so that's not an issue. You're not allowed to distribute or give away, it says, I think, the copies that you make, which sounds reasonable. And you can't sell them either. That's illegal. That's breaking copyright. And the copies have to be used for your personal use only. So taking my CD and not having a CD player in the car, I think it's quite legitimate to make a copy of that CD and create a USB drive with the same tracks on it. So the program I decided to use is called Fairstar's CD Ripper. The developers say that it's easy to use with a friendly interface, fairly standard interface. I guess it's fairly easy to use. It rips tracks to all kinds of different formats. So OGG is a Linux-type format people use. MP3, I guess, is probably the one that most people are familiar with. If you want high quality, then you can use something like WAV, WAV files. I'm just interested in MP3, so the car's good enough. One of the interesting things, it supports automatic volume adjustment, which some people call normalization. So if you have loud tracks and soft tracks on the same CD, it will kind of even things out and try and make everything sound about the same level. If you're interested in various tags for tracks, and it supports ID3 tags. And the interesting thing is it has the ability to go and look at an online database and obtain information about the title, the artist, the names of the tracks, the cover page, and all that kind of good stuff. And it also has a built-in audio player. So if you just want to play tracks, then you can do that too. So the interface is fairly basic. You can see up here it allows you to choose the CD or DVD player. You can choose different speeds, and then you got a whole bunch of different things you can do. When you put a CD into the DVD player, into the player, it immediately reads it, and you get a list of the tracks and the length and the size of the file that it's going to create. And you notice that I've suggested, by default, it's going to create MP3 files, I believe. Or you can select the different types right here. And however, notice up here is this this button called Query. So if you click on Query, then it goes out to this free database option on the web, looks up a bunch of stuff, and when you say OK, then it basically populates the name of the artist, the name of the album, gives you a genre, the year, it categorizes it, and it gives all the names of the individual tracks that are available. So now we're kind of in a position we can actually write these files to the disk. So we're going to extract, but we also need to tell it where to go to, select the output folder. So I'm going to choose this G drive, and I give the folder a name, basically the name of the artist and the album. And then I just say extract, and off she goes. It goes through the track one by one, and you can see that in fact it is taking this track and writing it to drive G, this folder, and it's using the name of the track with a .mp3 extension. And then I've got all these progress bars which are telling me how far we've got. So it turns out that by default, it stores things using the title. So you get the three titles right here. However, we just go back to here a second. You see that What Is Your Thing Called Love is actually track number 2 on the CD. But when you do a simple write the things by title, it basically arranges them in alphabetical order. So now What Is This Thing Called Love becomes track number 3 in the list of files. And the way around that is if you want to retain the original order of the tracks that were on the CD on your MP3 files, on the copies of the MP3 files, then you can select one of these options right here for the output file name type. And there's a whole raft of different things here. You can choose artists and albums and numbers and all kinds of good stuff. I basically chose number and title. So now I'm getting track number 1 and the title, track number 2, What Is the Thing Called Love, track number 3. So my songs are now in the same order that they were on the CD. So that's actually quite a nice little way to do things, and I found it actually quite useful. I noticed, I'm just looking at the chat here, and I noticed Tom is saying that FUBAR 2000 will do this and all kinds of other things. And I tried that, Tom, and one of the things I found was it doesn't have the LAME utility built in. So you have to go and find that, I think, and install it.
That's true. It doesn't have LAME built in. It's easy to find LAME, and it's easy to set it up so that you can write using LAME, for example. And you can set the parameters for LAME. So if, for example, you're copying an audiobook, you can restrict the bandwidth to 8 kilohertz in the audio and make the thing smaller. So, yes, you do have to download LAME separately. LAME stands for LAME is not a an MP3 expander or something like that. It's another
encoder.
So, at any rate, if you're going to think of this thing, then I would just also consider FUBAR 2000. There is a higher learning curve on it, I imagine, than your app.
Jeff's saying he purchased ExpressGrip, which is the NCH product, and it's similar. I actually tried that too, Jeff, and it works fine, but then it nags you to buy the pro version, as it were. So I decided I would just go with the free version, which works quite well. Okay, I think that's everything we had prepared. I believe there was a question early on. I don't know what else we've got. Chris, have you been anything we need to look at?
I don't recall seeing anything else in there that needed attention, so I think we can go on. I will say that it looks like we've got enough numbers who said that they were interested in a demo from Linda on background removal, so that will be in 2 weeks' time.
Okay, sounds good. Happy to do that.
So Micheline had a question early on about Word 365. Could it only be used with files in the cloud, or can you use it with files on your local PC? And Tristan replied that you can use it for both. However, Micheline says that when she uses Save As in Word 365, it only offers folders in OneDrive, which I find surprising. I would have thought that Save As, you could choose another drive and any folder that you wish. I don't know if anybody followed up on that. Anybody out there using Office 365?
Yes, I am. It's Corrine. I use it, and when I save files and you save as, I save it to my personal drive, not on OneDrive. So it's possible. I think you have to go in and you have to do some selection.
I've been chatting with her a little bit back and forth on a direct message. Turns out she's using the web-based version, which is a little bit different. There is when you do a save as, there is a download a copy option. However, it seems to currently have a bit of a bug where it just kind of flashes and goes away. I found the workaround is just to save it to OneDrive. Then there's an application launcher in the top left corner where you can then select OneDrive and manually download a copy from there.
However, if it's saved to OneDrive, by default, if you're using the web app, it'll save to OneDrive, then that should get reflected on your local computer anyways.
If it's synced, yes.
Yeah. If you set up syncing for OneDrive, then it'll automatically get copied down to your local drive.
I think I'm going to go down that rabbit hole in the next couple of weeks and try it, because I somehow mine seems automatically synced to OneDrive. And I'm reading things about deleting things on OneDrive. I delete it on your local. And so I think I'm going to try and figure that out, hopefully, in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, Alan's been doing some work on that front as well, doing some research and testing and things like that. Well, I guess not testing because he doesn't use OneDrive. But everything I've seen so far that he's put together, and it seems to sort of make sense. And Microsoft certainly wants you to use OneDrive with syncing, and they've made a mess of things, quite frankly. But it is possible to use OneDrive in a logical manner that doesn't necessarily mess up where things are and doesn't necessarily fill your available OneDrive space, which is, I forget what it is they give you.
5 gigabytes.
5 gigs for free. And if you have an Office 365 subscription, you get a terabyte of space available in OneDrive. But yeah, this is a little bit in different from what you're running into. The issues here really revolve around using the web app only for Word, PowerPoint, Excel, and where the files actually get saved in that case. So a little bit different, but relevant, but it's different from what you're running into. And I think there are ways of changing it so that your Office apps that are installed on your PC, which by default will save to OneDrive, and you can change that default so that it saves instead to your local drive. And as long as you save it to a location other than your local OneDrive folder, then it will be only stored locally on your PC. But yeah, we can certainly spend time on that at an upcoming Q&A.
Yeah, we're at the witching hour, so if you have any questions, now is the time to ask them. And there's a great question here from Jeff in the chat, and he says, is there a place in Zoom contacts where you can put recurring meeting IDs and passwords? And he's thinking about our meetings where we always have the same meeting ID and password. But he has to keep entering them, I guess. So he's asking, does Zoom store them anywhere?
I found that Zoom stores the meeting IDs, but you have to put in the password yourself. So there's a list when you open Zoom and say to join a meeting. Then there's you can click on the list where it shows you what you last connected to. And if you take the drop down from there, you'll find OPCUG somewhere in there.
Yeah, and the password is pretty easy.
In the web browser or in the app?
In the app.
In the app, yeah. And the password is real easy. It's OPCUG, all lowercase.
Really?
But as I put in the chat, if you go to the tiny, you just click on the tiny URL that I gave there, OPCUG-meeting, after tiny URL, that'll open up your web browser, and the first thing, it'll just ask you, oh, do you want to use the Zoom client? You click on yes, it'll open the Zoom client and connect to the meeting. So that to me is the simplest. It automatically will include the password. And if it doesn't work, some people said that it failed to connect sometimes. And so I also pasted in where that tiny URL actually takes you to, which is a much longer URL that it actually goes to. But if you do have problems, and if you're just storing it in a shortcut somewhere, there's no downside, I think, to using the longer URL that includes the meeting ID as well as the encrypted password as part of the URL. So just going to a URL, I find, is much simpler. That's what I do all the time to go to the PC user group meetings. So just use the URL. You get prompted, do you want to use the Zoom client? You say yes, and it opens.
I'd like to speak about the legalities of recording the CDs. Apparently, it's legal to copy your friends or probably the library CDs as well to your disk, so long as you're making the copy. And, of course, you're not allowed to distribute it. But so long as it's you make the copy and you make you do the ripping, then it's legal for you. The reason they did this, because I was involved with it way back when, about 15, 20 years ago, is that they put a levy on blank CDs to be able to compensate copyright holders. And in fact, they are, and I presume they still are, compensating copyright holders of audio material because you obviously use the blank CDs to make your copies, right? At least that's what you did 15 or 20 years ago. But that hasn't changed. So long as what you're copying is in your possession, then you do the copying, then it's yours. Now, you're not allowed to distribute them, give them away, or anything like that, but it's yours. So if you want to copy all of the City of Ottawa's CD audio books, you're welcome to.
Yeah, that's the understanding I always had with it as well, with copyright. Source didn't matter. If you are making, you can make a copy of anything for personal use, and the source doesn't matter, you're not allowed to redistribute it.
Yeah, the copyright laws on a lot of this sort of stuff are quite vague, because the whole purpose of public libraries for you know, hundreds of years has been that many, many, many people can read the same copyrighted book without having to pay royalties to the author. And that precedent has gone on through things like vinyl records, CDs, DVDs, videotapes, the whole bit. So as long as you're making a copy of just about anything for personal use, it's pretty much open for your personal use and not subject to copyright law.
But for what it's worth, I have an interesting story from, I don't know, about 60 years ago. Maybe only 55. But I was living in Berkeley around Telegraph Avenue, and there were a number of copy shops. Telegraph Avenue kind of leads into the University of Berkeley. It's kind of the main drag in Berkeley, connected with the campus. There were a number of copy shops around them, and you know, you could bring in an academic book or a treatise or your essay or whatever to these copy shops, and they would make copies of it for about 3 cents a page at that time. It was very convenient for students then to be able to get copies of these expensive textbooks that, you know, were like $20 or $30. Now they're $100+. Get copies of that. I actually used it for some of my astrology books.
Well, I have some bad news for you people. The Copyright Act, Section 29.22.1, Section B. The individual legally obtained the copy, other than by borrowing it. So you definitely cannot copy stuff that you've borrowed from the library legally.
What is the date of that version of the Copyright Act? Because I think that
today
that was,
I'm on the web.
Yeah, I seem to recall that it was it used to be source didn't matter, and that, you know, but they did a modification to the Copyright Act not all that long ago, and that sounds like a loophole they closed.
It's just last amended April 27th.
Of this year?
1982?
2023.
Okay, yeah. So it sounds like they closed that loophole. So that's too bad.
Okay, so Tristan had put a comment in the chat that for personal documentation, he's using the GitHub repository and the Markdown language, and he's agreed to give us a demo of that next Q&A, which will be in a couple of weeks. So we look forward to that, Tristan. Thank you. Okay, so we're just about at the magic time here, so I'm going to switch back to my screen share like that. and wrap up by saying that next week, Bob Harris is going to be talking about YouTube and all the tricks and traps to use YouTube efficiently. And I've seen a demo of some of this stuff, a preview, and there's a whole bunch of stuff I didn't know about YouTube. So I think it's going to be really, really interesting. So that's next week, next Wednesday, December the 13th.
Yeah, same here. I saw an advanced look at the deck and lots of stuff in there that I was not aware of that can certainly make it a lot more efficient to use YouTube. So I'm looking forward to the final cut of it.
And because that is our next week's meeting, of course, we don't have a Q&A when we have a regular meeting. So there will not be a Q&A next week. Our next Q&A will be in 2 weeks, as Chris said earlier. That will be on December the 20th. So that gives you lots of time to think about your questions and create slides for your shares and get everything to us at suggestion box so that we can slot you into the session. And I hope everybody enjoyed the stuff we had this week. And that's it for me. And we'll see you next week with Bob Harris.
Jeff, thanks for the note about OneDrive sync and that the default is not to download a copy, saving space on your local drive. I didn't know what the default was. So that, I think, is one of the things that comes to bite people in the behind when they find that their OneDrive is filled. They go to delete stuff on there, and it's the only copy that is anywhere. So, we'll be talking more about OneDrive in future Q&As and how to disengage from it or how to use it in a way that you're not going to get surprises of files not being available for you.
And just to add to that, Chris, if anybody is an expert on getting out of OneDrive from Windows 11, I'd really like to hear from you because A, I don't use OneDrive, and B, I don't have access to Windows 11. So if anybody knows how, I'd be really interested to chat to you.
I'm pretty sure that I know how to, it is enabled on my system, but I use it in a manner that nothing that I care about ever goes onto OneDrive. And I do know how, if there is something on OneDrive, whether it exists locally and in the cloud or just in the cloud, I know how to get it out. So I think that that's probably all that anybody really needs to know about. So we can work together on the slides for that, Alan.
I think it's a bit more complicated than that, Chris. I think there is a way in the new OneDrive on Windows 11 where you have stuff on the cloud and it's not on your local machine.
Exactly.
And that can be the problem.
Yeah, exactly. And I know how to get around that. If you find yourself in that situation and you want to stop that behavior, I know how to get your files down locally somewhere else so that they're safe and then stop using the OneDrive and it's possible. So there are a number of things, steps that you have to go through to make sure that you don't lose any data for sure.
Yeah, Mark Walker here on my Windows 11 for Luddite series. I'm going to be covering a little bit about OneDrive and
good.
What to do to get the hell out of it.
Good.
Because by default, you're stuck with it. And if during the initial setup, you sort of get out of it right then, and it eliminates a lot of problems that you might face later on.
Okay, so coming to a Q&A near you soon. Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you at the presentation next week for the monthly meeting and in Q&A in 2 weeks. Have a good evening.